work session. At least you got. If we want to start out with 2741, the backup bill, see where we're at. And I want learned counsel to. He's handed out a summary sheet of issues, right, counsel? Learned counsel?
That's correct.
Is it in here or is it some other place?
To the bottom of your packet.
Bottom of my packet. Here, don't let me use this one. This?
That's your packet.
This is my packet.
It's at the very bottom.
Bottom of this packet, which is sideways. Why is the crooked? Why did you do
that? Because there's so much paper that each bill is separate.
This is the first time you ever did this.
I did it to help you.
Thank you. I didn't understand why you did this.
Because you're always flipping through papers.
That's true. I know.
Take your bottom packet.
Yeah. Would you like to
have
a recess, Mr. Chair, so you and counsel could talk?
What's that? 3146 has got nothing to do with this. What are you doing?
Well, it does.
Oh, excuse me. Where are the rest of those individuals? Ernie? Are you with us here or not?
I was reading over some documentation on very important matters.
2741 or some other matters?
Some other matters.
That's what I thought. I want to bring somebody. I go out in the hallway looking for somebody. They're going to wish they had never seen me. I don't want you to start until, because I want to, we got to get.
Well, where's the sheets? Maybe we could do a.
All right, yes, we may do this. Hold it.
Ooh. Mr. Chair?
Just wait a minute. Don't get excited all of a sudden.
We can't go into work session anyway. Well, we got that. We can't go into work session yet.
Kelly's here.
That only gets us four. We can publicly hear, so we can do it. Yeah, we can move this.
This one here is no big deal?
Calorie.
We can move this.
Is it short?
Yeah, it's short.
Well, he's the Senate judiciary.
So I have one question about it.
Deborah, come forward, please. We're going to shift to Senate Bill 404. Get done what I can get done. Senate Bill 404. Deborah Wilson?
Yeah.
Assistant Attorney General? Here we go.
For the record, I'm Deborah Wilson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 404. Senate Bill 404 would prohibit expunction of certain crimes from a person's criminal or juvenile record. The bill would exclude Class C felonies and Class A misdemeanor offenses, including sex offenses against minors, criminal mistreatment of minors, and endangering the welfare of a minor from a list of offenses that may be removed from a person's criminal or delinquency record. This bill passed the Senate 30-0. The current law allows a juvenile or adult, after meeting certain conditions, to have their record expunged. Basically, upon an entry of an order of expungement, the perpetrator is deemed not to have been convicted of the offense, and if asked or if put down on an employment record, they are allowed to say they've never been convicted of such a crime. The purpose of the bill is twofold. First off, we want to guarantee that there's a criminal record of child abuse be available to programs or individuals responsible for caring for a child. Presently, if you had an individual, a juvenile or adult, who was convicted of sexually molesting a two-year-old, and they would apply to be a daycare provider in your home, a daycare provider in a daycare setting, foster parent, Fairview aide, nursing attendant, teacher's aide, Boy Scout leader, YMCA camp counselor, anything like that, there would be no record of that offense. The program would not be aware of the conviction for sexual molestation or criminal mistreatment, and they wouldn't be aware that it had occurred. The second purpose of the bill is that it does hamper investigations. When police want to investigate a new allegation of sexual abuse and they check the record will not show the previous conviction for sexual abuse. Once a person has been convicted of an offense involving a child, there's really no guarantee that they receive any kind of treatment or counseling so that they don't re-abuse. Often they just serve their time in jail and they're released. And an individual who abuses children is often likely to be a multiple or repeat offender. In one Oregon study here at the Oregon State Penitentiary, 53 child molesters and rapists, these men reported that they committed 25,000 sex offenses, which included 7,000 children. Their average age when they were first arrested and convicted was 26. An average of 6 more years passed before the men received any form of treatment. I know of, personally know of a case in Marion County where a Marion County juvenile probation officer was molesting young boys on his caseload. The boys were over 12 and they were under the age of 18, and basically it was touching of genitalia and masturbation. This conviction was in 1985 in Marion County. It was a sex abuse in the second degree charge because the child was over 12, so it's a Class A misdemeanor.
Ms. Wilson, I'm going to interrupt you and ask you a couple questions about a larger issue. Granted, if we're going to have expunction statutes, we probably ought to prohibit expunction for sex offenses and child abuse. So I have no problem with this bill as far as it goes. My problem is with, is twofold. One, the expunction statutes have never made sense to me, just as a matter of logic. Mm-hmm. It just has never made sense to me. And I've done some for people, as I've represented people, to have their records expunged, and it doesn't make sense to me. And so I guess my question is, if you hate expunction, if one hates expunction, what's one's position on Senate Bill 404? And secondly, you may be the wrong person to ask on this, but we've got sentencing guidelines over here coming down the road, and a whole bunch of sentencing guidelines has to do with criminal history. Now, the sentencing guidelines people are telling me that the sentencing guidelines don't affect the expunction statutes, that basically they're still in effect. Sentencing guidelines, last week, I understand the council or the board removed this conviction-free period from the rules, but you still got the expunction statutes out there. And if we're trying to figure out somebody's criminal history for purposes of sentencing guidelines, or if an employer, for that matter, is trying to figure out somebody's criminal history, why in the world the expunction process is around? I mean, there's a conversation that's gone on before I got here, and I don't understand it. So before we start talking about limiting expunction, maybe you can do an advocacy for expunction in the first instance.
I'm sure that back when they adopted the laws and when they, and case law, when it's taken a look at it, they thought that there are probably certain crimes where it would be to the best interest of the public to be able to expunge that from their record if it was a one-time offense. It didn't occur again in 3 years. There had been some adequate protection that they wouldn't repeat the offense, and therefore that they should expunge their record and give them kind of a fresh start, a clean look. The reason why that has not worked or does not work in sex abuse cases, and sometimes does not work in particular with this statute, particularly for sex abuse offenses, is because, in fact, a lot of times people do not get any kind of treatment for sex abuse offenses, and when they do not, the recidivism rate is very high, and it puts the children at a very high risk. And also the fact that, again, we know a lot now about sex abuse and sex abuse crimes and child abuse than we knew way back when in terms of expunction. And I think when they listed certain crimes that can be expunged and those that could be not, sex abuse was certainly had not come of age, and there was just not the educational awareness of the problem that there is now. So that, you know, that may be why there should be an exception now when there was not one back then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Council?
Debbie, I have a question about the choice was made in terms of drafting the bill, because there's something in here that I don't understand. On page 2, actually, it's done a couple of different times, when they talk about except for the following crimes which would constitute child abuse, and then you refer to the child abuse reporting statutes. Why was the decision made to go that way as opposed to just talking about victims of those crimes under the age of whatever they would be? It seems to me in light of that you start to put an element of criminality in the child abuse reporting statutes that doesn't currently exist, and I think that could allow this to be misread as those acts, in fact, being criminal, and I know that they are, but there's an aura of criminality that you then attach to the child abuse reporting statutes, and this committee has gone round and round on that issue, and it concerns me in the way that this reads, and couldn't you not accomplish the same thing by just talking about the age of the victim?
No, I do know that although I didn't draft that specific section, I do know that the reason for putting that section in was to make sure that this would only be for a person who was under the age of 18, so it would talk about expunction or not expunctioning records when the child was a minor. So that's the reason why that wording was put in, why it was not just would constitute child abuse because the victim was under the age of 18. I'm not exactly sure why that wording was chosen since I didn't draft the bill, that specific part of the bill.
Okay. Do you have more, Debbie, or?
No, that's it, unless there are any other questions in regards to the bill itself or the purpose of the bill.
Mr. Lewis, would you come up, Mr. Lewis? Why don't you stay there, Debbie? He's against the bill, and what's your name, please, and your position on this bill, please?
My name is Philip Lewis. I'm an attorney from Portland. I'm against the bill. I never testified before a committee before, so
it's a tough bill to do it, possibly.
I know that I have.
I mean, don't worry. Don't get shook up. I'm just sort of. I reacted. I shouldn't. So don't be shook up about that.
I came down here on 2 hours' notice because I think it's a very, very important matter, and I think it's a kind of bill that a lot of people can very quickly vote against without much thought because they think it's a very good thing to vote for. They're going to vote for it because everybody's against sex abuse, and they're against sex offenders, which is, I think, a correct position to have in a sense, but I think the bill is going to be counterproductive. I'm not a psychologist. I'm a criminal defense attorney. I can only speak from my own experience in these cases. I've been doing this for 10 years. I've represented several dozen people, sex offenders, of all types. As you all know, it's a very, very complicated issue. There aren't any simple answers. Excuse me, I'm used to talking to juries, but I get nervous talking to a committee.
Like sort of a very bad judge.
No.
I'll try to be polite anyway. Okay. Well,
it's a good judge. Kind of a very stupid jury. Just think of it as kind of.
That makes it easier.
Here you go.
I don't think that the problem of child sex abuse lends itself to a get-tough approach, which many people have voiced in speeches or in papers. And I think that when people voice that kind of approach, they do so in good faith because they want to do something, and they want people to think that they are doing something about this problem. What's impressed me over the years in representing these people is that, and I'm talking about sex offenders, or another word for them is child molesters, is that most of the people I've represented, now I'm not a public defender, so I represent primarily middle class people, but the people that I've seen have impressed me because they're not like drug dealers, they're not like pimps, they're not like prostitutes or car thieves who view the legal system as a cost of doing business. They hate what they do, they hate other child molesters, they don't view it as a hobby or anything that they're proud of. They're ashamed of it, and it's a deep, dark secret that they tend to carry with them. Oftentimes, however, as those of you, I think Representative Clark mentioned that you've represented people in criminal cases before. I don't know if you've represented sex offenders, but people who are accused of these crimes face a number of decisions, and the first one is whether to admit or deny the allegations. And if they're innocent, of course, they have no choice but to deny if they are innocent, and sometimes people do get accused falsely. It has to happen because we're all human beings. But those who are guilty still deny an awful lot, and they deny and deny because they can't admit to themselves sometimes. And the hardest thing that we all have to deal with in these cases is, in order to help the victims in these cases and the families that are involved, is to get people to take a look at their own selves and to begin to admit their liability, to admit their fault, to admit that they've got a problem. And in a lot of cases, people walk in, they burst into tears in the lawyer's office, and they say, I've done a horrible thing. Please, I can't afford to go to the penitentiary. They're thinking they're going to go to the penitentiary forever because they don't know what really happens in these cases, which is that we've got a pretty enlightened approach in Oregon. But a lot of people are very, very reluctant to admit because they're very, very afraid of a lot of things. I think that this bill, if it has any effect at all, is going to be counterproductive, and it's going to hurt families, And it's going to, in the long run, and in the short run also, hurt a lot of victims, because it helps victims and it helps the families, because these are usually family crimes, and I noticed that it's before a family justice committee. When the person continues to deny his wrongdoing when he's really guilty. Now, as a defense attorney, sometimes you have to get people on these kinds of cases, I believe, to try to come clean, because it helps your client to come clean, so you can get him into a psychologist who's good at dealing with these kinds of people. And if you can tell him that you might be able to get a deal where he pleads to a Class C felony, if that's what he's guilty of, and only one count, mind you, he'll be encouraged to come clean and admit. Now, I think the bill is counterproductive, because it would take away that added incentive to come clean. Second of all, I don't think it's necessary, because any prosecutor, just about any prosecutor, can work a deal if he wants to or she wants to, so that expungement becomes totally irrelevant, because as most of or all of you know, and the expungement statutes, I think, are somewhat inartfully drafted, and they're kind of complicated, but if a person pleads guilty to more than one count of something, or if he pleads to a B or an A felony, expungement is never going to be available. And almost every case involves multiple counts, and prosecutors oftentimes will deal away additional counts or knock something down to a Class C felony, so it will be expungible. So this bill helps promote admissions, and it helps promote plea bargaining. And that helps out the victims. And I know that's what I found from my own experience. I could be wrong. I don't know.
Representative Clark, do you have a question a few minutes ago?
Mr. Lewis.
Yes.
I don't know if you heard my exchange with Ms. Wilson about...
A little bit, about why have expungements at all.
Yeah, and in some ways what you're saying strengthens my conviction on that, because if...
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
But.
No, I mean, you may be saying one of two things to us. You may be saying, hey, don't single out sex offenders in the expunction process by excluding them from the expunction process. Doesn't the same, if, are you saying don't single out sex offenders, or are you saying don't limit expunction? In other words, if expunction was available to nobody,
mm-hmm.
what would your position be? Because I think I can make an argument that in order to help your clients come clean, one of the things they need to know is, if convicted, this conviction is going to be on the record forever. And we don't pretend like it never happened. There are consequences to these actions, and one of the consequences is that you have a criminal record. And we're sorry about that. You can go on with your life, but I, for one, don't believe that you ought to be able to act like it just never happened. And that's been the
nobody does that
catch point.
And that's my experience in talking to my clients, and I've tracked some of them over the years to find out how things are going, and I've kept in touch with the psychologists that they've dealt with. You know, in a sense, almost, if you're going to have an expungement statute, it should apply especially to these people. And
I understand. You can make that argument. No, I understand.
Because the car thieves and the drug dealers, and this is one reason why I kind of
if you can ever make, I mean, let me put words in your mouth.
Sure.
If you can ever make an argument that somebody is sick and needs to be made well,
certainly.
And not evil and needs to be made good, then you can make it in the case of a sex offender.
That's right.
That's putting words in your mouth, but I understand that.
No, I agree with you 100%.
If you can ever make that case.
Drug dealers view this whole process as a cost of doing business. The car thieves do. The sex offenders that come from all walks of life, they're car dealers, they're representatives of this, everybody.
Right, no, I understand.
And they usually abhor what they've done.
And it's closer to an addiction than perhaps anything except for actual alcohol and drugs.
But I think that the bill can be counterproductive also, and I think it can act to hurt victims. I don't think that this bill really helps victims. And I think that it's not going to prevent sex abuse from happening. You can't do that by passing laws. I think we need to deal with the problem at its source, and that's to help the people involved, and right now we don't have a lot that people without funds can even do to get the kind of help that they need. I hope that you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. One more witness, and I want to move some other bills. Where's the note? Well, well. On this, please.
My name is Jean Duell. I live in Salem, Oregon. My husband died in the state penitentiary because he was a child abuser. At one time, the first time we found out that it happened, we went through approximately $15,000 worth of psychiatric testing and help. It was not reported to the police at that time by the family. 5 years later, I walked in and found him abusing my own daughter. It was reported to the police. He went through the court system. He was on 5 years of probation, of which, to my knowledge, he was clean during that time. We went through it. The whole family went through it. It wasn't just my husband. When I walked down the street in my hometown, people would not speak to me. He was allowed to be a teacher's aide in a school. He was allowed to do many things. He was a Sunday school teacher. He was a very upstanding man, okay? I can remember one morning I walked down the street. It was about 6 o'clock in the morning. I could not sleep, and I was walking over to a friend's house to have coffee. There were some men who were standing by the road, and they shouted at me, and they were men that I had known all my life, "You tell your husband to keep your hands out of my little girl's pants." That was a very demoralizing thing for me. My children were demoralized by this. At the end of 5 years, we had gone through the Marion County sex abusers thing. In fact, I helped write part of the manuals that were supposed to help these men in Linn County. They don't help, gentlemen and ladies. They're going to go out and they're going to do it again. They are sick. They do need help. In the case, 3 years after he was off probation, his record was expunged. 14 months later, he went from sexually abusing little girls to sexually abusing a little boy who happened to be in our home that my son was babysitting with. It went through court again. I divorced the man. I provided all of the documentation to show that he had done it before, because there was no record any place that this man had ever done it before. It has cost me jobs, because people didn't come to me and say, "This is what your husband did when my child was in your home." I recently had a case of a little girl that I babysat with 14 years ago. The mother called and said, "Jean, I've known you all my life. Did you know?" Her daughter had become involved in illicit affairs. She was 17 years old. When they took her to a psychiatrist, it came out that while she was in my home, unbeknownst to me, my husband had sexually abused this child. It has cost me numerous jobs that I didn't even know that was the reason, because people knew, and they judged me by it. They judged my children by it. When I was called to testify before a grand jury, I could not do it because I did not have firsthand knowledge about what they were asking about. But when they did call me and say, "Do you have any court records?" "We can't find any." I provided them with two apple boxes full of information that for some reason I hadn't thrown away. This put my husband behind bars, my ex-husband at that time. But he did not ever molest another child. He no longer hurt himself. He no longer hurt our family. In fact, we changed our name. Duell is not the name, not my husband's name. My son refused to sign his last name on papers. He flunked the class because there were too many Brads in the class, and the teacher didn't know whose papers were who. It has affected our family life to this day. It has affected my daughter. I was sexually abused as a child, and the person was never criminally indicted. It affects you all your life. This is not something that just is a little 15-minute thing or an ongoing thing for 4 or 5 years. It affects you all your life. I think that any person who is a sexual abuser needs help. They need it desperately. But until that help is available medically and clinically, there needs to be an ongoing record that these people do this. Since my husband died on January 11th, 2 years ago, I have found out of 25 children that I personally knew that he sexually abused. These were children that I had as a teacher in school. They would come home and we'd have picnics. These are people that I babysat with. And gentlemen, I did not know what was going on. He would do it so quickly. And sexual abusers will tell you, they can sit in a room with you and sexually abuse a child, or the parents can be there, and you will never know they're doing it. This is something that really needs to be taken care of. And the men who do it need to know that there is stiff penalties and that they need to go and get help before it happens or when they feel about it the first time before it becomes a crime. It is a crime. It's a crime against society. When you realize that every house you walk by, every third house probably has someone who has done sexual abuse or a sexually abused child in that home, it becomes a very dominant factor in our life. And those are just the reported cases. I have sat in groups of women where there were 10 and 20 women, and there would be as many as 90% of the women in those groups had been sexually abused when they were children. I have worked in this area a little bit. I've counseled a little bit in this area. I'm a professional person in the mental health field now. I am for this bill, and gentlemen, I would urge you to pass it. Thank you.
Last question I have. Your husband is a child.
He was sexually abused as a child. He was abandoned by his mother at the age of four. He never knew his father. His father lived in a town 14 miles from him, and they never had a father-son relationship. His stepfather refused to view him as a son. He was a perfect textbook case. I've read about it a lot since then in psychology books.
Well, this committee hears a lot about the effects of child abuse on people who, when they become adults, and so.
But Representative Courtney, I was sexually abused as a child, and
no,
I don't sexually abuse
no,
people,
I'm
so it doesn't
saying,
have to happen that
no,
way.
No, I support the bill and everything. I'm just afraid that it's just another statement on this whole area of sexually abusing children, child abuse, the whole thing. It's overwhelming sometimes.
It is overwhelming.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions for Ms. Bull? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right, let's move on. What should I do? I want to go to 479. I know that it's time to do whatever we're going to do with the bill, up or down. 479, excuse me.
Do you want to stay on 404 for a minute?
Session 404.
Good. Would you like to do that? Let's go to session 404.
Chair, I move an amendment to Senate Bill 404 that would delete everything after line 5.
Where is it now? Please, I can't hear you.
Would delete everything after line 5. And replace it with a repeal of ORS 137.225.
Mr. Chairman, I like the idea.
I bet you do. I wish you'd shared that with me a little sooner.
I thought I just did.
Yeah, I didn't know you were going to hit me so quick.
Easy to do.
Simple bill.
The Lenin Clause is there. And
you understand what we're doing?
Mr. Chair, let me explain what I'm doing, and I'm deadly serious about it.
I understand you're deadly serious.
And I
Deborah.
I'm not wild-eyed. Not a law and order issue.
Do you know what we're thinking about doing here? Deborah?
Yeah.
You know what we're thinking about doing?
Mr. Chair, what we're thinking about doing is deleting Senate Bill 404 to the extent that it comes to us as limiting expunction for sex offenses only and repealing the expunction statute outright.
Do you understand that?
Yes, I do.
to the motion, Mr. Chair?
I have a feeling that unless you say something, it's gone. So, I mean, that's not for sure, but I'm just saying it's this committee moves, they do. The phrase, how do you eat an elephant? They eat it with one gulp.
Right.
And, I mean,
instead
you
of one small bite at a time.
Mr. Chair, it certainly doesn't offend the purpose of the bill, which is to...
No, I in that regard, I certainly have no position on that, because it certainly does not change at all the Department of Justice position on the bill.
Explain to the motion, Mr. Chair. As I said before, the expunction process has never made any sense. There are whole lots of things we can do to rehabilitate people that we think are rehabilitatable. It has nothing to do with any of that in my view. It's simply saying we ought not engage in this fiction of pretending like a crime never happened when it did. And as a personal aside, that the times that I have been most uneasy about my work as a practicing lawyer have been when I've gone into court and had someone's criminal record expunged, and for all practical purposes, it is as if that crime never happened. And that's not right. It makes no sense. So that's the motion.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that it also makes sense in view of sentencing guidelines.
Especially in view of sentencing guidelines.
And the way that they handle past offenses.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, a fundamental assumption of sentencing guidelines is that we want to know what somebody's criminal history is. And if we're going to get an accurate record of criminal history, it doesn't make sense to have a whole bunch of offenses be expunged.
I just want to make sure, would that also include under the juvenile section, totally eliminating any expunction under that?
One of the things I just thought we should do.
I would not be in favor of eliminating the expunction option for someone who committed an offense as a juvenile.
I am.
Here we are. I think we
I'll amend my motion along those lines. It's,
that's the thing. We're moving so quickly. I mean, I have to admit, I understand your intent, but yes, Kelly.
Chair, members of the committee, you'll note that on page 4 of the printed bill, section 2 was a different section of the ORS citation. So actually, Representative Clark's motion and the way that he did it in the amendment, what he's doing, I think would only get you. You can in fact deal with the issue in two parts because of the way that the bill is drafted and put together. The adult section and the juvenile section are dealt separately. And
I guess the key question is, as I read the amendments, talking about the police officer and the party leaving.
Yeah, that's what I
don't see this as saying the police officer leaves and leaves the party sitting
there. That's what our impression
is.
Mr. Chair, this is not the objection. Terry Rogers for the record from Legal Aid, representing the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. Our objection here is that this individual has a temporary restraining order, which the actions being described in Representative Minnis's amendment, essentially violates. If the person is likely to become violent, then the person is already interfering with the petitioner in terms of violating the temporary restraining order. But more important, one more concept. In the whole domestic violence situation, if when the abuser begins to get menacing or harassing, all of these things requiring arrest under our law, particularly in this situation where there's a temporary restraining order, it is the duty of the law enforcement officer to arrest. Otherwise, we are saying, as a social policy, we approve, we're going to leave you alone, and we're going to take the victim out of this situation. I feel that by leaving the bill alone in the form that it has come to you from the Senate, we are not changing the law in any way in terms of mandatory arrest or the practice out there. The problem here is that this language proposed by Representative Minnis will definitely undercut the mandatory arrest law. And what we want to do is go ahead with this bill and leave the I can't deal with the practice or change.
Mr. Chairman, I want to interrupt. Terry, where does this amendment supersede ORS 133055 in the mandatory arrest statute? How does it do that? Because it does nothing, as far as I can tell, to rescind anything in that statute that indicates when there's probable cause to make an arrest for either harassment or assault, that the officer would not have to make that arrest.
We can certainly clarify that.
One second. Okay. Do you have a response, Terry, or am I going to go to the other? I trust that.
We feel that the language of the amendment and the proposed amendment and 133055 sub 2 are inconsistent. When a peace officer is at the scene of a domestic disturbance, which this one has become by definition in Representative Minnis's language, and has probable cause to believe an assault has occurred, et cetera, or to believe that one person has placed the other in fear of imminent serious physical injury, the officer shall arrest. And when we're talking about terminating under these circumstances, especially with a TRO already in effect, that this sends a terrible signal to abusers. And this is the problem that women have been facing in terms of domestic violence legislation.
Nick Calhoun, please. And then I'll come Representative Clark and Brian.
I think, and I've had to deal with this some, I think the current domestic violence mandatory arrest statute has to do with an act that's already occurred. So there's this act that's already occurred. I don't know if we can strike some kind of compromise to make this thing make sense or not, but I think what
the amendment is trying to get at anyway is what happens if he stays there, these two people are going to get in a big fist fight. Can they terminate the contact to try to stop that from happening, or does he have to stay there and go through it anyway?
Can I respond to that?
Yeah, that's
you're there with a court order in hand that says this person is allowed to go to that residence to retrieve a bottle of pills, a prescription, their driver's license, and XYZ. And that's the extent of it. To the and at that point you have some person who's there whose duty it is to enforce that court order to assist that individual to enforce that court order. So that if, in fact, that's the duty, to allow that individual to exercise the court order and to see that it's done. Now, if there is some harassment on the basis of the individual who doesn't allow that to happen, that's when the officer would arrest the other, should arrest the, if you're interfering with the ability to deal with the court order, then that's where, you know, we're not talking about any old argument here. We are talking about a court order that allows you to do certain kinds of things, and to collect a very, and if there's any arguments or there's interfering with that activity, then I suppose you could start all over again. But that whoever interferes with that activity, I think it has, would expect that there an arrest be an arrest be made based on interference.
Chairman,
could I just? I'm not trying to keep you, but the other two have been. Which Representative Bryan, Representative Clark, do you still wish to comment? I know that you were okay. Representative, let's go, Representative Clark, then Representative Bryan, Representative Minutes. I'm just trying to.
What I hear happening is I hear the witnesses reacting to an amendment that Representative Minnis says is different from the amendment that he's trying to introduce. And if that's the case, then what we need to do, it seems to me, is to clarify what it is Representative Minnis is trying to do, and then get the witness's reaction to it. And I think what Representative Minnis is saying is that you want the contact, if violence is about to happen, you want the police officer to have the authority temporarily to get the accompanied party out of there, terminating the contact to that extent, which would not necessarily affect the duty that the police officer is under to make the arrest. I mean, I read your amendment as simply saying, rather than stand there for this 20 minutes, watch the situation degenerate into violence, and not have any authority to do anything other than stay there, you want the police officer to have the authority to get the situation resolved, then come back and make the arrest if need be. I mean, is that what you're trying to do?
That's exactly what I'm trying to do, and I think there's a misconception on. Now it's subject to mandatory arrest. That's not true. Probable cause to arrest anybody for harassment.
There are other elements in the law that require
mandatory arrest statutes are tied to harassment and assault. The police officer has to evaluate what's occurred in their presence. They will not prosecute on. The mere interference.
Mr.
Can I complete what I'm saying, please?
Yeah, we have a response here. Are you ready?
Temporary restraining order, which is a civil enforcement tool.
We
have this document, and you're sending a police officer into that premise. Have someone go inside and get certain objects inside that home, that it's, at least in my opinion, unfair to walk that person into the home, and then the minute the person who's at home says something obnoxious, they're all of a sudden in violation of this restraining order, and they get to go to jail.
Mr.
Because So we've got a mixture of different types of enforcement tools. I want the police officer to simply be able to maintain order while they're on the premise. And that's all I'm trying to do.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Maureen McKnight, a lawyer at Oregon Legal Services. I think in regards to Representative Minnis's objections, it is imperative that we refer to the language which is legislatively mandated for restraining orders, and that is, it appears in Chapter 107, and it basically says that the respondent is restrained or prohibited from in any manner molesting, interfering with, or menacing the petitioner. And it's the coalition's position that if the, in terms of the language that Representative Minnis is proposing, that if the officer is faced with a situation in what he feels is, quote, likely to become violent or getting ugly, or however you want to call it, either by threats or actions against the petitioner or the officer, then the person making those threats or taking those actions violates the restraining order, whether you call it interference or harassment or molesting or whatever. Whether it constitutes a separate crime of assault or harassment or whatever isn't the issue, because the mandatory duty to arrest, it hinges on the violation of the restraining order and not the separate satisfaction of elements of a specific crime. And Representative Minnis's amendment would allow, it basically is taking a different legislative stance by saying, even though you've got a situation where the officer feels it's getting violent, and obviously someone has to have done something to have the officer feel that way, that we're not going to consider that interfering either with the petitioner and her removal of the items, and we're simply going to withdraw and not arrest for that. And since those decisions were made prior, we feel it's a definite retreat from the current law.
The conversation seems to always assume it's a one-sided argument at the home. What I'm talking about is the party who is accompanied often gets caught up in the fray again. Now, if it was just a one side where someone's trying to interfere with the service of the restraining order, I think the officer's going to respond in time to get that person out of the way. I'm talking about, I can foresee where things start getting heated up again. And I don't think it's an officer's duty to stand by and wait for a criminal act to be committed.
Again, the point is he need not wait for a criminal act. If we're talking about a situation where the respondent is the one who is interfering or acting, the arrest duty is automatically triggered by that action, separate from any crime that may be committed, because the TRO prohibits him from interfering, molesting with, or yes, it is in the bill. I'm sorry.
Can you refer to the bill so they can read it?
Yes, that would be on page 5 of the bill on line 5. And again, I note for the committee that this is language that is mandated. This appears in every county's forms. Ordered that the respondent is restrained or prohibited from in any manner molesting, interfering with, or menacing the petitioner. And the statute, regardless of the existence, again, of any crime per se, the occurrence of interference and the officer's probable cause to believe that interference has occurred mandates arrest under 133.310. Doesn't matter if there's a separate crime. And
Chair.
Response as to whether or not the accompanied party is caught up in the fray. The reference is back to the respondent rather than the accompanied party. I mean, I have seen it where the accompanied party gets involved back into the fray. And I'd hate to end up waiting for things where I'm arresting the person that was being accompanied as well as the other person. I mean, there's no sense of prevention here, which, I'd say probably 80-90% of the family beef responses are settled with some sort of separation, prevention, cooling period rather than arrest. And it just tries to close the door on that.
Representative.
I'm not trying to shut you down. Representative Clark, you...
Chair, I'm going to try, at the risk of failing in an attempt to impersonate Representative Mannix, I'm going to try...
Amanda Mannix.
I'm going to try maybe to clarify something with a word or two. It seems to me that what Representative Minnis is getting at is not necessarily whether one has to arrest under existing law, but how that arrest happens. And I'm going to propose that
and this may not be final language, I think the problem is with the language and not with the idea, but if we added on the fourth line of Representative Menace's amendment after the word authority, if we added the word temporarily and then put a sentence at the end, something to the effect that it would not otherwise affect the duty to arrest under the statute that you referenced earlier for a violation of a restraining order. I think what Representative Menace is saying is he's got a concern about how, not only what happens there during this 20-minute period of time, but let's say a peace officer decides to go ahead and make an arrest for violation of a restraining order, how that happens. And I don't know enough, I don't know whether it happens now that the police officer has to stand there while the people are, the parties are warring, but it seems to me that if you add temporarily terminate the contact, and then it does not otherwise affect the duty to arrest under the restraining order statutes. I mean, you folks know a whole lot better than I do that a restraining order is just a piece of paper. And it doesn't protect anybody. It's a declaration is what it is. Now, Representative Menace, is that a fair statement of what you're trying to get at?
I agree. I'm not trying to get the police officer out of any duty to arrest under a restraining order. My only contention is that this is a situation where the government and I'm picturing this from a practitioner's point of view. A police officer shows high emotions involved in a domestic assault. You naturally have when you've injected yourself into one of party separate and terminated if it becomes necessary.
Mr. Chair, that is the law. What Representative Menace is expressing is the law. It is handled by peace officers all over the state. I grant you in different ways. We think that the version of the bill that is before you without Representative Menace's amendments is absolutely neutral. This is not going to change the practice of peace officers in Oregon in terms of handling temporary restraining orders, and we think that any attempt to improve on this language is going to basically undercut the law as it exists now. Peace officers use a great deal of discretion in the entire execution of their duty, and we do not wish to change that. We wish only to allow a peace officer to accompany somebody who already has a temporary restraining order from a court to get to remove essential personal effects.
Calhoun. Okay, what we're trying to do here is get the person's effects out of the house, right?
Correct.
Okay, if there's going to be a problem with the two people fighting, couldn't the police officer just go in and personally remove those effects? Would that solve the problem, or does the person have to actually be there?
Again, the bill doesn't say, and it would not necessarily be easy to tell somebody where things are, like telling somebody where this pot is and that pot is when they're helping you cook in the kitchen. A lot of the times when this has happened around the state with peace officers who do this voluntarily now, you go at a time when the abuser is not there. And the vast majority of the cases, when the peace officer is going to accompany the petitioner, the woman, and the person is there, the presence of the peace officer is going to calm everything down, and that's why we want it. This is a dangerous situation, and women's shelters often accompany people now, and that is what we need to get away from. The peace officer is going to calm the situation down, and I think that the law gives I think we've got a clear law, and I'm not trying to change the practice in the field with this bill, and that we ought to go with it.
Mr.
About the comment on the practice in the field, I don't think that the officers in counties, and I don't think I've ever seen, none of those counties at least, the officers followed the letter of the law in always arresting somebody in domestic violence situations, even though the law tells them they have to. And I don't know exactly what the reason for that is, but a lot of times they cool off, and later on, by the time the officer shows up, everybody's lovey-dovey. Under the law, they'd have to arrest
them. Wait, no, Mr. Chair, I want to correct that. if the police officer has probable cause to believe that arrest is warranted, they have to make the arrest. It's not as if every time the law does not require them to arrest someone every time they go to a domestic violence scene. That I want to make that clear and clarify that.
I don't know if that's consistent with the way the law is written.
Well, I think, yes, it is. And you still have probable cause to arrest. We haven't changed that. We just said you don't have to ask the – what we've taken out is you don't ask the victim if they want to be – if they want the other person to be arrested. So it's you still have to have probable cause to arrest, and at that point you do have to arrest. You can't –
What I'm saying is a lot of times they'll go out, there will have been some kind of domestic fight, but they say, okay, it's cooled down now, can you
That's
guys
fine.
Take
there's
it easy?
There's no probable cause,
but,
and there's no duty to
well,
arrest.
Well, if they know that somebody was beating on somebody else, they've got an assault for or harassment, they should have to arrest under the statute, under the literal reading of the statute, I think.
That's right.
But they don't as a matter of practice. But anyway, that's off point. Mr. Chair, go ahead.
I had thought things were different than they were, and they are not. Senator Cohen, I know, has many things to do, as does everyone else. I think we're going to have to move on because things aren't going right.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Senator Representative Clark said that he'd like to go outside with Representative Minnis and you individuals for 20 minutes. I don't know whether that means you're going to have a cup of coffee for 20 minutes or what, but I'm just saying I had thought that things were a little better and up and down. They're not, and I'm not one to, I sense we've reached a point where we're not sufficiently together. Because I think I'm not going to ask Senator Cohen the ultimate question in terms of this amendment is made part of this bill, whether or not they want the bill. I'm not going to do that, Senator Cohen, in front of us. But
okay. Mr. Chair,
well, I'm just saying it.
Send them to the woodshed, Mr. Chair. Send them out.
I don't send anybody to the woodshed. That's not my style. Okay, Senator Cohen, thank you for coming over. I would like to now move on to another bill, and not vote as I thought I could on Senate Bill 479 because. It's just, anyway.
There may be a consensus on the vote that maybe hearing lots of disagreement on the committee, sir.
Well, no, I think I can't support, just so you know, I can't support the amendment. I think it's just, you would be divided vote, and the question becomes, what does it do to the makers, to the primary movers of the bill in terms of they, you know, how strongly they feel about the bill after that? Now, maybe
they,
no, don't take it. What? No, well.
I mean, we're playing politics. We might as well do one or the other.
I'm not trying to play politics. I'm just saying it's just not the. I haven't.
Playing politics.
We can. Chair. Ms. Chair.
Representative Cohen.
I just want to reiterate. Send him to the woodshed. Woodshed, Ms. Chair.
We need a quorum. I mean, they all disappear. We don't
have a quorum. Well, yeah. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Mr. Chair.
No. Well, then I'm going to go.
Mr. Chair.
Why should I
Mr. Chair? Just for the record, Mr. Chair, I want to say that they've all gone into the woodshed now.
Let's go to another couple of bills. Can we go to the... See, that's just not what I told everybody here, though.
Oh, all right. Let's talk about
I think this...
Didn't anybody take it in?
2741?
Oh, we're going to do tobacco next.
Oh, good. That'll be fun.
Let's do tobacco.
Yeah.
Yeah. If we got enough people, we can do tobacco.
We got another.
Okay. Let's go.
3741.
We got a real simple position on this bill.
This one we won't fight on.
No.
This one we won't go up and smoke.
Mr. Chair, members.
Are we in work session now, Mr. Chair?
Well, we're, combination. Let's go.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you will find in your packets a copy of the bill, a copy of the staff measure summary. A four-page document that has some options on it that for the committee's consideration, which I will go through, and a copy of House Bill 3146, which passed the floor yesterday or day before yesterday. The reason that I put that in there was to sort of set the stage for the committee. The House has recently passed legislation which would increase the penalties on sellers of cigarettes. And so at this point, there's still continuing to be no sanctions for those that purchase them. So it kind of sets the stage as the ante has been upped on the sellers, and the committee is looking at the issue of what should happen to the buyers. Now, I have crafted for the committee three options. And I think what I would like the committee to do is turn to page 4 of my document, and look at the summaries of options, and there are really four big issues that the committee needs to address, and then we can go back through the actual concepts if you want to. Based on the conversation that the committee had last week, my starting off point was that anything that the committee crafted would be a violation, which means that there would only be fines or community services attached, that there would be no possibility of incarceration for the juvenile in question. So that's where, under summaries of options number two, you see as the penalties of the violations that there would either be no penalties, a fine, or community service. I'm on page four at the end.
Thank you.
I'm working backwards because that's the kind of day it is.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the material being referenced.
It's in your packet of information that was distributed today.
No.
Okay, here's a packet for Representative Bryan. It's okay. We got it coming to you now.
Yeah. Thank you.
Very good.
The second question I think that the committee can consider is whether or not they want to set the age at 18 or 21. The reason that the age of 21 came up was because that's what the minor in possession statute is. Alcohol is prohibited for individuals under the age of 21, and so I thought in terms of crafting options that I would put it on the page. The third option, and I'm really jumping all over the place here, has to do with parental liability and involvement of parents. In the curfew statutes, if a parent knowingly knows that their kid is in violation of curfew, a sanction can be brought against the parents. That goes in one direction. In the MIP statutes, a minor or a person under 21 can drink at home with their parents' permission. So if you look at the MIP statutes as one model, it takes the role of the parents in one direction, which is basically sanctioning the behavior so long as it's at home. If you look at the curfew statute, it treats the parents in a totally opposite way and says, if your child knowingly does this, we're going to hit you as well. So there is that range of options to consider. And the fourth one has to do with whether or not the committee wants to tie in additional juvenile court proceedings. One option would be just say that the juvenile court, that a child would be in violation and that they would have to pay a fine or do some sort of community service. The other step would also be to potentially subject the minor to other sanctions within the juvenile court arena so that the court could take additional jurisdiction and do other kinds of things. So those are the four big issues I think that the committee needs to consider in terms of doing this. If we then go back to page one of my document, for option one is modeled after the curfew law, states that no minor shall be in possession, and that the only other option that it states is that any minor who violates this section may be taken into custody. There are no specific fines or provisions, fines or community service in option one. Option two is modeled after the minor in possession statute, so it's set at 21. It only has a fine provision, and then there's language at the bottom of page two, which says that a child could basically smoke at home if they had their parents' consent. That models part of the MIP statute. And option three is a combination of those two, and it does three things: that no minor shall use or be in possession of any tobacco product, that any person who violates that section would be subject to a fine of no more than $250. Or 48 hours of community service, and then I tacked on the third part of the curfew statute, which says that a minor may be subjected to further proceedings, which would be juvenile court jurisdiction, temporary custody, and the parent penalty provisions. So that's your menu.
Okay, committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Edmondson.
Well, First, I should compliment Holly on really doing a great job here. As has been stated elsewhere, it was my personal opinion that we should, that we're basically, I hate the word, but we're trying to send a message here. We're not trying to put people
on that word.
We're trying to level the playing field and like really simple state what has been the law for years. Let's see.
The bill it should pass.
Good bill it should pass with these things. I do have a
I
couple
don't
of questions.
I want to hear harmless.
And it would not hold harmless or create any new liabilities.
I not would, a smoke screen either.
It's not, there's no, there, we're not, it's not going to overcrowd our prisons or...
this has a ways and means impact. I don't want to hear that.
A little concerned about smoke and mirrors, but I think mirrors have been taken care of in other buildings. I would like to ask a couple questions.
Yes.
Turning to option one, which seems to be the most acceptable, I think, personally. You down here in your note about ORS 419 and 419 make it a Class A misdemeanor for a parent to allow a minor to violate curfew. You're not suggesting if we enacted this that we would be creating a similar misdemeanor offense for parents who somehow allowed their kids to use tobacco or were aware of it. I mean,
all I'm saying is that it's an option that exists and you can choose.
But it is limited only to curfew now.
Correct.
Okay. Well, the whole thrust Actually. Of this really is rather than lock the parents up or allow them to consent to this, would be to simply that they be notified of this. I think this is essentially something that parents need to work with their kids on. And the, you know, I'm a strong advocate of parents trying to explain to their children why they shouldn't be smoking for health and other reasons. So that's kind of the thrust of it, Mr. Chair. And I would say that on the option, the menus here, 18, I think it has to be at 18. I'm not interested in people who are full participants in our democratic process to be subject to this. I do believe that this bill is not intended to get at adult behavior. So we're talking about minors, and those are under 18. The penalties, I mean, I'm not interested in fines or no penalties other than the community service looks like it might be an option, if in serious enough things. But really, what I want is to let the schools feel that they don't have to offer smoking areas and that they can confiscate. And that parents should be aware of what their kids are doing on street corners. So I guess I would, with that little those remarks, I would favor the option one.
So, just
well, there's more than one. I'm somewhat confused to how you've done this, Holly. I mean, okay. This option one doesn't speak to the 18 or 21, does it?
It's minor.
Minor.
Chairman.
Okay, now I'm starting to figure out how you did it. Yes, please, Representative Flora.
Can I make a little different suggestion? And that is, we go through. The right at the end, which is summary of issues. I mean, it says options, but it should say issues.
Yeah, that's
no, it shouldn't.
Yes, it should.
Well, everything nice that was said about Holly has just been taken back, Rose in glory. But okay, let's start. I think that's. Can we do that? Let's go to the bottom of page four. Is it a couple? You know where you are and everything.
Salem, Oregon.
All right. Let's talk about the 18 versus 21.